Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google KubeCon Extravaganza. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. If you're wondering why this podcast is a day late, well, we put it out on Wednesday this week instead of the usual Tuesday so that we could give you an update on all the news from KubeCon, and boy, is there a lot.
Indeed. But first, the important update of what happened with Bird of the Year.
Well, after a tense race over the past few weeks with some serious electioneering and amid reports of ballot stuffing and other voter fraud, it turns out New Zealand's Bird of the Year is the kakapo, the world's fattest parrot, probably down to the fact it can't fly. Any fans of BBC television may have seen one trying to have it off with Stephen Fry's head in an episode of a Nature's program a few years back. The kakapo is so rare that they only have, I want to say, 206 of them. I'm not sure if I got the number exactly right, but they know exactly how many there are. They keep them on an island for the purpose of conservation.
Congratulations to the kakapo and its victory there. One other note of housekeeping. We'll be taking some time off coming up. In particular, we're taking 2 weeks around the American Thanksgiving holiday and another couple of weeks at the end of the year. So our next episode after this will be on December 8th. We hope you all get a chance to take some time off and relax as well.
Shall we get to the news?
Let's get to the news.
Congratulations to our friends at Bonsai Cloud, our guests on episode 59. Cisco has just announced their intent to acquire Bonsai and merge the company into their emerging technology and incubation team, which is where their PortShift acquisition also landed. Cisco said that they intend for the team to continue to innovate in the areas of networking, security, and edge computing. Terms of the acquisition have not been released.
The CNCF have released the results of their 2020 Cloud Native Survey. Highlights include that 92% of respondents use containers in production, up from 84% last year.
91% use Kubernetes, and 83% use it in production, up from 78% last year.
Weekly app releases are most common, done by 26% of respondents, but 29% of respondents released daily or multiple times a day.
82% use CI/CD, with Jenkins leading the pack at 53%.
30% are using serverless in production, with 60% of those using a hosted platform.
27% use a server mesh in production, with 47% running Istio. 37% use a service proxy, with a majority using Nginx.
And finally, 55% have containers with stateful applications running in production.
Red Hat has made a number of announcements this week. Updates to OpenShift include a new edge computing feature for remote worker nodes, which are managed by a control plane back at your HQ. To show what you might do at your edge, the Red Hat team published a blueprint for machine inference-based anomaly detection on time series sensor data. OpenShift is now available in the government clouds run by AWS and Microsoft. Additionally, a Red Hat AWS jointly managed version of OpenShift, similar to the Azure offering, has been announced. Knative eventing is now supported by OpenShift Serverless, and the cloud-native Java stack provided by Quarkus is now available as part of an OpenShift subscription.
The CNCF end user community has published its third tech radar, this time focusing on database storage. The radar suggests adoption of MySQL, Postgres, Elasticsearch, Kafka, Memcached, and Redis. The trial tier brings in Cassandra, Consul, and MongoDB, as well as the cloud-hosted options of BigQuery, Google Cloud SQL, Aurora, and DynamoDB. The final category of Assess contains CockroachDB, MariaDB, and Vitess. The community is also bumping up its training benefits, with end-user members receiving a 15-seat starter pack with unlimited access to e-learning resources and one certification exam each. End-user supporters will receive 5 codes for 100% off e-learning or certification. For the broader community of users who have passed the Certified Kubernetes Administrator exam, the Certified Kubernetes Security Specialist exam and certification are now generally available.
Congratulations to the Envoy Mobile project, which joins its older sibling in the CNCF. Envoy Mobile brings the benefits of the Envoy XDS APIs to mobile applications and developers running on Android and iOS. It has bindings for Swift, Kotlin, Objective-C, and Java, and powers Lyft's production mobile apps. 7 sandbox projects were also approved. Cert Manager, the popular tool from Jetstack, covered in episode 75.
Amazon's Cloud Development Kit for Kubernetes, CDKs.
The Kiverno, Kubernetes native policy engine.
OpenCruise with a K, a Kubernetes automation suite for workload management.
Pravega, a storage abstraction based on streams.
Schema Hero, an operator for database schema migration.
And Tinkerbell, a bare metal provisioning engine and the hardest of all these projects to Google for.
DataStax, our guest on episode 98, has released Kate Sandra, an open source distribution of Apache Cassandra running on Kubernetes with elastic scale and auto healing functionality built in. The new distribution is designed to help DBAs and SREs easily manage a cloud-native database and integrates with Prometheus and Grafana for monitoring and observability.
K8S was compiled down into one binary in the form of Rancher's K3S. If that sounds like three too many for you, check out K0S from Mirantis. K0S promises zero-friction Kubernetes with zero dependencies and zero cost. The project is still at 0.7, but it's derived from the production Mirantis Kubernetes engine, and 1.0 is promised for early next year.
Solo.io, our guest on episode 55 and makers of the Glue API Gateway, as well as a bunch of other things, has rebranded their entire portfolio around the Glue brand. Service Mesh Hub becomes Glue Mesh, with a new Glue Mesh Enterprise offering production support for Istio.
VMware dreams of a world where a single authentication process of your choice can be used to log into all of your clusters, cloud and on-prem. To that end, they launched Project Pinniped, which delivers a consistent user authentication experience in Kubernetes. Using Pinniped, you're able to log in once to safely access many clusters, using standards-based protocols and login flows, and integrating with external identity providers. Pinniped is the Latin for seal, perhaps a tenuous marine connection to Kubernetes, but the project hopes to get your seal of approval. Their pun, not ours.
Shippa, an application management startup which launched in October, has open-sourced its engine. Ketch, a two-masted sailboat, is the name of a new application delivery framework for Kubernetes. It allows you to deploy and manage applications with a command line interface and no YAML.
Want a Kubernetes dashboard and not impressed with Lens, Octant, Infra.app, the dashboard from your vendor, or the upstream Kubernetes dashboard? In the time-honored tradition of open source, Kinvolk found fault with all of those and built their own, which they call Headlamp. Headlamp is extensible, role-aware, and scratches their exact itch. If you think it might scratch yours too, check it out. Kinvolk also announced new versions of their Flatcar Linux distribution, including an LTS version for stability and compliance, a pro version optimized for cloud use, and a free version available in the marketplace of the three major cloud vendors.
The Spiffy Project, building a secure production identity framework for everyone, has published a book explaining how to establish trust in your infrastructure. Solving the bottom turtle refers to the famous theory that the world rests on a turtle's back, raising the question of what that turtle is standing on. Spiffy aims to put an end to the infinite pile of reptiles, and this book explains how and why. You could also listen to episode 45.
If you want to get a feeling for what it is like to develop for Google's Anthos platform, now all you need is a Google account. No credit card required. The Anthos Developer Sandbox packages up the Cloud Code IDE and container build tools into Google's Cloud Shell, giving you everything you need to iterate on, debug, and test your applications before deploying to Anthos. Google also announced new ingress features to GKE, with SSL policies and custom health checks now generally available, and HTTP to HTTPS redirects now in beta.
Ambassador Labs, formerly Datawire, closed an $18 million US dollar Series B financing round this week to continue to grow their cloud-native API gateway and finally allow them to grow the team in Canada they've always wanted. The first order of business was releasing version 1.9 of their API gateway and Edge Stack, which adds IP allow deny lists and customizable user-friendly error messages. They also announced version 1.0 of the K8S initializer, a tool that enables developers to configure a full platform stack on Kubernetes with some of their favorite tools. No prizes for guessing which ingress it installs. Ambassador also pre-announced version 2 of Telepresence, their CNCF sandbox two-way proxy for fast code testing and deployment. The new version will be rewritten in Go to better align with the contributor community while also increasing speed and performance.
VMware has sprinkled some Tanzu over the pivotal Postgres operator and released VMware Tanzu SQL, now generally available. The operator allows self-service and automated deployment of Postgres on any certified Kubernetes runtime, with official support available running on VMware's products or GKE.
And now it's time for the famous Kubernetes podcast from Google, KubeCon Lightning Round. In the traditional alphabetical order,
Accurix, a cloud-based cybersecurity company, has announced that their open-source static code analyzer Terrascan has been extended to support Helm and Customize.
Amazon added container support to their LightSail virtual servers.
Aricto, with a K, announced a $10 million Series A, led by Unusual Ventures, to build GitOps for machine learning.
Brobridge released a microservices data caching and provisioning platform called Gravity.
CircleCI announced the GA of their runner service to build and test code remotely for teams that want to deploy on-prem.
Cloud66 announced a new version of Maestro designed for web development agencies, SkyCap version 2 with several new features designed for easy multi-environment deployments, and multi-database support for both platforms.
Cloudflare released a Cert Manager plugin for the Origin Certificate Authority they use for their CDN customers.
Cloudicle announced the soft launch of their GDPR-focused Vanilla Cloud, a hosted Kubernetes service located in Germany and available in multi-tenant and dedicated varieties.
Cloudify announced version 5.1 of their open-source multi-cloud orchestration platform that uses layers of abstraction to enable easy migration between different Kubernetes environments.
Codefresh has released a number of new observability and logic features in their CI/CD tools as part of an effort to brand what they are calling GitOps 2.0.
Commvault announced Metallic VM and Kubernetes Backup Solution, a backup-as-a-service offering for container applications.
Diamante has added support for AWS in their Spectra 3.1 and Ultima services. They also released a new customer portal called Diamante Central.
Dynatrace pre-announced the release of PurePath 4 coming in the next quarter. The latest iteration of their distributed tracing and code path analysis tool will add support for OpenTelemetry and W3C Trace Context, Service Mesh, and serverless functions from all three major clouds.
Elasticsearch released their open-source compliant Kubernetes as GA.
Fairwinds introduced a Kubernetes maturity model for identifying which of seven phases your organization is in and how to get to the next.
Garden has come out of stealth mode with €3.1 million in funding for their unified development, testing, and continuous integration platform for cloud-native applications.
Gremlin, our guest on episode 82, has announced new soundproofing features to its chaos testing tools to help protect applications from so-called noisy neighbors in a shared host environment.
Humio announced the availability of an operator to deploy their open-source Kubernetes configuration management and deployment tool.
Instana announced that their application performance management and observability tools are now deployable on top of Kubernetes.
Intuit announced that they are now running the majority of TurboTax critical services on Kubernetes.
Kioxio has announced a new storage offering to provide block, file, and object storage simultaneously to Kubernetes via high-performance NVMe flash storage.
KubeCost, our guests on episode 124, have added features to look at cloud costs outside of the Kubernetes cluster.
KubeMQ has released an update to their message queuing system that does automatic network creation to simplify setting up bridges, connectors, parameters, and config files.
Kubermatic released Kube 1 version 1.1, the latest version of their open-source cluster lifecycle management tool for single Kubernetes clusters. The new release adds a cluster autoscaler and can mirror Docker images into a private registry.
Kubernative has announced a change in strategy to focus on Cyna, their software hub used to install software and its dependencies directly into your cluster.
Kubler has released version 1.19, which includes a new user interface, full support for external clusters, AWS configurability improvements, and chaos engineering integration with Litmus Chaos.
LevelUp has announced a new release candidate of version 2009 of their backend AI open source machine learning platform to manage computing resources and software.
Magalix launched KubeAdvisor 2.0, which now provides dozens of built-in policies for a 360 view of Kubernetes security, governance, and operational visibility. Additionally, reports identifying CVEs at the OS, orchestrator, network, and other critical entities are now generated by the tool.
Maya Data, our guest in episode 56, has announced the commercial availability of Kubera Propel and Kubera Chaos. Propel is based on OpenEBS, and Chaos is based on Maya Data's chaos engineering project Litmus.
Mirantis, our guest on episode 110, have announced an extensions API for their Lens Kubernetes IDE, allowing for developers and partners to create add-ons for visibility, security, API gateway access, and more.
Puppet Labs is integrating their event-driven automation platform Relay with their Puppet Enterprise product. They additionally announced Puppet Connect, which is designed to connect people with self-service tasks and agentless orchestration across infrastructures.
Reblaze Technologies has launched CuraFence, an open-source Envoy extension for securing web applications, sites, and APIs. The tool includes bot management, a web application firewall, application layer DDoS protection, session profiling, advanced rate limiting, and more.
Replicated has announced that they are making their troubleshooting tools available as a separate open-source project called Troubleshoot. The tool will help ease the challenge of installing applications on remote and air-gapped systems. It has two parts, a pre-flight tool to validate an environment before install, and a support bundle tool to record logs from the installation.
Styra, our guests on episode 101, and the creators of the Open Policy Agent, have released several new editions of their declarative authorization service, giving them a free, pro, and enterprise edition.
Sysdig added network visibility and segmentation with the announcement of Zero Trust Network Security for Kubernetes, with the unfortunately unpronounceable acronym of Sysdig. They also expanded partnership with IBM by adding Sysdig Secure to the existing Monitor product to enable broader security scanning of CI/CD pipelines running in Big Blue's cloud.
Trilio announced Trilio Vault for Kubernetes 2.0 to do backups of Kubernetes, including in multi-cloud deployments.
Zerto announced the beta of Zerto for Kubernetes, an extension to their existing data recovery platform to support cloud-native applications.
And that's the lightning round.
Finally, if you're not sated for Kubernetes content by the end of this week, Google Cloud is hosting a free online event as part of their Open Source Live series. The event features Kubernetes maintainers talking about API requests, admission webhooks, server-side apply, and etcd. Live Q&A will be available throughout, and there will be a wrap-up where speakers and attendees can connect. The event takes place on December the 3rd from 9 a.m. to 11 Pacific, and you can find a registration link, as well as links to everything else we've mentioned today, in the show notes.
And that, my friends, is the news.
Stephen Augustus is a senior open source engineer on the VMware Tanzu team. He is an upstream leader in the Kubernetes community, currently serving as chair of SIG Release and with a hand in many other contributor groups. He is the co-chair of this week's Virtual KubeCon North America event. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hello, hello. Good to see you all. Hear you all.
How are you doing? It's been a tough time. I'm sure it's been a very busy few weeks for you.
Yeah, it's been crazy is the nicest way to put it. Lots of things going on. Exciting nonetheless. I think what we put together is the culmination of a lot of the work that we've done across the community for the year. So it's always fun.
And you're in New York City. I imagine that's probably been an interesting place to be the last few weeks as well.
Yeah, New York always keeps it interesting. I think what's been going on with the overall situation with COVID, as well as election results coming out, I think the city has been a little bit more alive than I would expect it to be right now.
Let's focus first of all on this week's KubeCon event. We spoke with your co-chair, Constance Karamanlis, in episode 117. She said that for the event that you were working on together, the Europe event was planned to be in person and went virtual, but this is the first event that was actually virtual from the beginning. Her suggestions were more content, more whiteboards, and more puppies. How did you manage to bring that to life?
Ultimately, what I love about these conferences is the hallway track. Really, I spend more time in the hallway track than I do attending talks. Mm-hmm. It's the opportunity for a lot of us to get together for the every 4 months that we have it. This time around, definitely felt like we wanted to do more around making it feel like we were in the hallway. Seeing some of the work on the Twitch stream that's now live for CNCF, as well as some of the activities that we're planning for the happy hours, all of the Slack sessions and breakout rooms that we've got going on in the conference, as well as the community days. Ultimately, the goal is to make people feel like they're in the room.
How do you bring something like SIG Late Night online?
Very, very hard to replicate, especially given the fact that it's usually not time-bound. If you've heard of SIG Friday, I think, has been our best approximation of what SIG Late Night was. Every Friday, we hang out and talk about life, talk about work, talk about not work, talk about learning. That has given me some of the vibes of late night. It's also gotten people more accustomed to just hanging out with friends on a video call as opposed to in person.
There are a lot of occasions at the conference where you see large groups of people who obviously have worked together a lot, and there are a lot of people for whom that's their first time attending a conference. It can be hard for them to get in with those kind of groups, and maybe it can be even harder to do that online. What would you recommend to someone who's perhaps seeing names of people that they've heard on this podcast or they've seen in the community and they want to reach out to them? What would you recommend they do in the virtual sense?
I would say just do it. It's very easy to say that after getting to know some of these people for a few years, but we all started as baby contributors, poking around the cloud native space and trying to learn a little more. Really, one of the biggest suggestions I could give is attend the 101 track talks. The 101 track was specifically designed to help people onboard into the community and give them an idea of the resources that they should be looking for and the people that they should be contacting. So do that. Hang out on Slack. Get on both the Cloud Native Foundation Slack as well as the Kubernetes Slack if Kubernetes is your thing. Lots of channels to hang out. Everyone is incredibly friendly and happy to help when they're available.
Make sure you check out the Kubernetes podcast Slack channel. Place to be. You say there, everyone starts off as a baby contributor. Your experience with Cloud Native started at a startup that was in the early days of Kubernetes. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with containers and Cloud Native.
My career is, I think, going on 15 years long at this point. Mm-hmm. I've done a variety of different things, the classic corporate IT, desktop help desk support, sysadmin stuff, security engineering, network engineering. Eventually started looking at what's next? What's the next move in the career? And it was looking like operations. This is right around the time that the DevOps was getting really buzzwordy. And I was like, that's the thing that I want to do. That seems interesting.
I'll do the second half of that, please.
Just only the second half.
Just the ops.
So I think given the opportunity to kind of leverage everything that you've learned from the ops space and start to learn a little bit more about the dev space, start to learn a little bit more about cloud computing in general, gave me an opportunity to reach a little deeper into this community. It started at a startup where we were doing some investigations of containerized services. We had our production services, classic three-tier application on AWS, and a lot of works in the background for staging environment that was running on Docker Swarm. Mm-hmm. We had another DevOps engineer on that team looking into Rancher. When I came onto the team, that seemed to be this gap in the middle that needed to be filled in terms of discovery. For me, that ended up being Kubernetes. Kubernetes ended up being a lot of the technologies down the CoreOS stack. So looking at service discovery in etcd, Fleet and Flannel for network overlays, as well as overall service management. And that ultimately led me to Kubernetes. And my rallying cry for the company was, Google runs on the order of 2 billion containers a week with a technology that looks a lot like this. I think we don't have those goals. Mm-hmm. I think this technology can more than meet what we're trying to achieve. I spent quite a bit of time digging up issues in our icebox, right, our backlog, and playing around with etcd, doing different things, standing up clusters. And we started investigating Tectonic at the time and reaching out to some folks over at CoreOS. At the time, the sales team that they sent to us was Alex Polvey and Redbeard and Jeff Gray, who was their VP of Biz Dev. They sent out the heavy hitters.
That's the CEO and CTO and so on?
Yeah.
I guess that is a small company. They wear many hats.
Yeah. Very enthused with everything that they were working on and their general vision for cloud native technologies. Ultimately, that led me to CoreOS. I think I was the only customer to employee conversion at CoreOS, and that was part of my bio when I came on board. Really working through that and getting to work together with people who basically influenced part of my growing as a DevOps SRE production engineer type.
You've gone through a couple of big acquisitions in the cloud native space. First of all, let's talk about the acquisition of CoreOS by Red Hat. How was that process?
I remember that vividly. We were prepping for an all hands, or I was flying out to San Francisco for what was supposed to be the sales kickoff for that quarter. Mm-hmm. I was going through security with the all hands on my headphones, and it cut out a little bit in the airport, and I was pinging people on the Slack channel, and I was like, what did I just hear? I said, something acquired by blank. They're like, yeah, we just got acquired by Red Hat. And I was like, oh, wow. Flying out to sales kickoff became like flying out to our acquisition celebration. Really, really great experience at the beginning. And moving forward, I was on the field engineering team at CoreOS. I said to myself, we know this technology cold. We implement it for customers every day. They need to know who does this. They need to know who had a hand in putting together these solutions. And I decided to move into the OpenShift Tiger team. It's one of the specialist solutions architecture teams for Red Hat. If we're going to sell our technology, our baby, I want to make sure that someone who worked on it is in the front of that. That was my goal within the acquisition. We spent a lot of time interfacing with customers, thinking through their migration strategies for Quay, as well as migration strategies for older customers moving from Tectonic into OpenShift, as well for OpenShift customers who are moving from 3.9 to 11, really, into OpenShift 4X, which was that integration.
OpenShift 95.
OpenShift 3.1, right? Which was really the integration with all of the Tectonic components. That journey was fun. We got a lot out of it and built something better as a result.
Was it around that time that you started getting involved with the upstream Kubernetes release process?
Yeah, Kubernetes was dragging me in for a bit, the wider community. At CoreOS, I was working with Starbucks, mm-hmm. and they were interested in Tectonic on Azure. Tectonic on Azure was pre-alpha at the time. So I wrote a good chunk of what was Tectonic on Azure. And to answer some of those questions, some of the stack was Terraform-based. So going to the Terraform community and figuring out what module didn't work with Azure and hacking up some solutions. So spending a little time working with the Terraform folks and then also realizing that not all of the answers existed in those Terraform modules and that maybe I had to go further upstream. Mm-hmm. I spent some time in SIG Azure, eventually chairing that, then also got more interested in the release process, some in documentation, and it kind of took off from there.
How many people did it take to release Kubernetes when you first got involved? And how many people does it take today?
I would say it doesn't take that many previously. Mm-hmm. It's about key people. When I was just getting involved in the release process, it was very Google-centric. The people who had the keys to do releases were heavily Google employees. We started shifting that process outward into the community. It's a great success, I would say. There's the release engineering components of the process, but also the people components of the process. So between the release engineering sub-project and the release team sub-project, the release team is this team of amazingly equipped cat herders, which focus on various areas. In total, the release team at any one time could be between 25 and 40 people. And they focus on various areas, whether it be bug triage, issue triage, CI signal, communications components of it, the enhancements components of it. Each of those subteams has a lead. Each of those leads has a set of shadows. The goal is to better understand the process, become an effective leader, be able to lead your subgroup, and then maybe eventually lead the release. My rallying cry sometimes is, we're going to delete the release team. One day, less cat herding will be needed. The process just flows and the requirement for the team goes down. So right now, a lot. Soon, maybe less.
So you're employed now by VMware, and I understand you got there through the Heptio acquisition.
I did. Acquisitions. Man. I was actually looking at Heptio right as they were getting acquired and thought to myself, we've got some time on this. They're probably being targeted for acquisition at this point, but we've probably got a year.
And you were at the airport on your way to the sales kickoff.
During my interview process, actually, it was when they made the announcement. When I got my offer letter was on VMware paper.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever officially work for Heptio? Is there an internal group for the old timers? Did they let you into it?
There's a Heptio OG Slack.
I'm glad that you were able to get onto that.
Yeah. I had to beg and plead. Now, the relationship with all of the CoreOS folks, a lot of the field engineering team, solutions architecture groups moved to Heptio during and soon after the acquisition. Mm-hmm. It was really an opportunity to work with my old boss, amazing person, as well as my old team. It felt really natural to go back to that team vibe.
Was the upstream work that you'd done part of the benefit that you could bring to the company? Was that something that they looked very fondly upon?
Absolutely. At Heptio's core and definitely across VMware, the need is growing and the recognition that upstream is paramount to the success of the company. And outside of finding contributors, what it's really important to do is find people who are willing to provide sustained effort into any one thing. So looking for leadership in the community and looking for something that I felt that I was quickly establishing during that time was definitely an additional checkbox for coming into the group.
Let's talk about some of those leadership positions that you've had. You were one of the leads of SIG PM, and that was the product, project, or program management SIG, depending on what day of the week it was and how you chose to look at it. That SIG doesn't exist anymore. So you might be in a good position to talk about why it started and why it ended.
Yeah, of course, there's some deep, dark history and magic to Kubernetes that I find out a little bit more every day. But initially, when SIG PM spun up, the idea is Kubernetes, while it's an open source project, it's something that we as a community depend on deeply across vendors and end users. And, mm-hmm. and in that sense, Kubernetes is also a product. Whether or not certain people look at it that way, that's what it is. From the perspective of the way that we organize our governance model, Kubernetes is also a program. The way we carve out these different explicit programs to focus on the horizontal and vertical efforts, SIG PM made a lot of sense to try to apply what is classically the PXM methodologies to an open source project. Mm-hmm. Some of our learnings have been interesting, namely that it's hard to do and maybe it can't be done. Mm-hmm. As we grew in SIG PM, we learned some of this. All of the people who have been SIG PM chairs or involved have deep, deep experience in product program project management and their day-to-day jobs.
Right.
I was not one of them. I was just an organized engineer at times. And often when you're organized enough and you're available and you're interested in the work, you can do the work in open source. People will enable you and give you that space to learn. My career in SigPM started as part of when I joined the release team. So I joined the release team as a features shadow under Ihor.
Mm-hmm. Which release was that?
1.10? Yeah. Feels like decades ago at this point.
Okay.
I joined and was very interested in the features collection process, what's now the enhancement process and everything that kind of goes into that. I realized it was broken.
Mm-hmm.
What I hope for out of any release team member is that they learn and they grow and then they leave. They recognize some deeper problem in the community that is related to that area that they may be working in. So you think, again, with the release team, we've got essentially these arms out into various areas of the community. So you think communications has an arm out to contributor experience, and CI Signal has an arm out into SIG testing, and enhancements had an arm out into SIG PM, and so on and so forth. My hope for a release team member is that they eventually grow into pushing the boundaries of that arm and trying to fix some inherent problem. I found features collection, the enhancement tracking spreadsheet, and all of the business around the beginning of the release cycle to be a huge burden, both for the release team as well as literally every SIG who buys into the release train. My goal was to try to fix what of it I could. The nugget that we got out of this was the enhancements process, Kubernetes enhancement proposal that came forth. This is something that was developed based on the thinking of the Python enhancement proposals and also the Rust RFCs. So just being able to describe what we do and make sure that we can commit it to the project's history, just as we would any piece of code, was huge. Being able to look back into our history and understand why we made the decisions that we made instead of having them in GitHub issues.
And it's also very useful for going forward. So for the people who aren't familiar with the process, when you want to enhance Kubernetes in some way, it might involve dozens of commits or issues, but you actually have one document that says, here's what I want to achieve, and then maybe even break that down into documents and how you'll get that feature from inception to alpha to beta to GA and so on.
Exactly. Between the work of some folks like Eric Toon way back in the features collection process, and then also Caleb Miles and Jace Singer Dumars, I remember when I was getting started and Jace was like, are you sure that this is the thing that you want to work on? It has a lot of history behind it, and there's a big potential for ruffling feathers. I want to make sure that you're comfortable with that before we get into fundamentally changing something that is core to the community now. It was exciting, and I think that at the time, I was the bright-eyed contributor, and was like, yeah, let's do it. Just give me that thing. And
did you end up ruffling any feathers?
Oh, for sure, for sure. We ruffle feathers to date. What's interesting about the process is that the process is also subject to the process.
Mm-hmm.
So when we improve the idea of enhancements, we have to step back into our enhancement proposal, right? We have a metakep, which describes improvements to keps overall. We're working on what should be a big one for 1.21, which I'm excited about. It's called the receipts process.
Mm-hmm.
The receipts process is essentially, we want to reverse this push-pull mechanism that we have with the release team reaching out to people and dragging information out, figuring out where documents are attaching, connecting all of the dots between the docs and the Kubernetes PRs and the tests and implementation history and putting that all in one place, and instead do what we might do in an organization and have groups commit to the work that they're going to do. Again, it's going to be YAML because we love YAML and cloud native.
Who doesn't?
The idea is that the way we have the enhancements tracking spreadsheet right now that gives you an idea of what's being tracked, what's at risk, what's been kicked out of the release, any exceptions, so on and so forth, we want to put that in YAML. Being able to aggregate all of these, get these receipts, basically run a tool on it, generate a manifest that gives you an idea of exactly what's in the release. Part of that tooling will be applying pre-submits to some of those folders so that your receipt won't merge unless you do these things. It doesn't have a thing attached, it doesn't have a docs PR attached, it doesn't have the right status on your KEP. Starting to tie the threads, the reason that we created the metadata for the KEP into what is something that people have looked for since the start of the project was really like a roadmap, starting to be able to get at least a clear vision of what's happening in a release with a lot less human toil. And then putting this up on a website, putting this in a way that's consumable, whether it be an end user who just wants to look at a website or maybe a SIG who wants to ingest this data and get a report of what's at risk for them or maybe what they're planning for the next few cycles.
Can we hold the next release until Sidecar containers are ready?
Sidecar containers have been requested for quite a bit. And I think that ultimately, when we push forward enhancements, it's always important that we do the right things at the right time and try to make sure that the enhancements that we release are as stable as they can be before releasing them to the community. Corollary for that is the PRR that has recently popped up, or the production readiness review. Mm-hmm. That becomes a requirement of the KEP, where you basically have to describe how your feature, your enhancement is going to react in production, because this is what people really care about. If I run this on my cluster, is everything going to go horribly wrong? Getting a little stronger validation from enhancement owners about whether or not that's true is definitely part of it. Sidecar containers, I'm not sure when they're coming, but if everyone's following the process, we have a lot more clear idea of what is coming and how it's coming in. Maybe getting to the point where people are less scared of consuming a .0 Kubernetes release, which I think is a common bit of feedback I've heard.
So you could always go with the id software mantra, where it'll be ready like a week after the last person asks about it.
Like, now is it time? Is it time? Should we go now?
I just asked again, so I'm sorry. I've reset the clock.
And we're running into code freeze right now for 120. So
you're the co-chair of SIG Release, along with Tim Pepper, who was our guest of episode 10 when he was working on a release at that time. He's rotating out of the lead role at the moment. Tell a little bit about that decision and how you're keeping the team growing.
One, Tim is a phenomenal co-chair. I love the fact that we started at the same time. This is something that, again, I kind of follow Jace's roles. Jace was a chair for SIG Azure, worked on SIG PM, and was one of the chairs when I started off in SIG Release. This is something I poked them about being interested in, and just poked and poked. And one day, Jace was like, it's time, I'm doing it. I'm going to step down and give an opportunity for some new blood to come in. Mm-hmm. Tim and I were in that meeting, and we were like, hands up immediately. We're the ones. Pick us. We had been doing the work at the time. It was a good opportunity to really step into leadership. SIG Release has taught me so much about how to be a leader. I'm still learning and growing every day. And definitely having someone senior like Tim in the cockpit with you, steering through this stuff and trying to understand the vagaries of the release engineering tooling, how we make things better for everyone, balancing those priorities. Him and I have very different styles, I would say. A matter of experience, Tim is incredibly methodical, well-written as well, and has deep, deep experience in software architecture. I'm coming from the ops side. I'm coming from small mid-businesses where ultimately, if the thing falls down, even if it wasn't your thing, you own it. You own making sure that happens. I often bias towards action. Yes, we might break the thing, but as a result, we might learn something. We might learn some nugget that we didn't have before. Tim is the slow and steady. I'm the move fast and break things. That struck a really great balance for the SIG. Mm-hmm. Going into the release team and maybe eventually dissolving that sub-project, again, this is probably a few years out if we were to ever consider.
Is it your goal just to dissolve every SIG that you're ever involved in? Automate yourself out of a job.
Basically, DevOps for Kubernetes, right? Mm-hmm. Part of what we did is we started to take some of the technical roles around release engineering tooling and pull them into their own sub-project. That became the release engineering sub-project. And that was guided by the branch managers who are on each release team, as well as the patch release team members. Normally, the patch release team members were responsible for one explicit set of Kubernetes minor patches. If you got 110, you were on the 110 train until 110 was deprecated. We decided that that model wasn't necessarily great for sustainability. If a patch release team member needs to roll off and they're no longer covering their branch, then we have to find coverage for that. So we eventually made this team of just release managers and release manager associates, where they would be responsible for doing all of the things. whether it's anything around branch management actually cutting the releases, and they would share the responsibility across all of the in-support release cycles. And then as well as having this kind of associates team, which are mentees to the release manager's proper group. This model is somewhat adapted from the at the time, the product security team, now the product security committee. We were like, this is a nice model to bring people into a role that's incredibly privileged in the community, right? These folks have the ability to essentially blow up Kubernetes if they did the wrong thing. So it was important for us to allow time to learn and grow these tools, as well as make the tools safer to use so that we could bring more people into the process. And I think that we did a good job doing that. We've done a great job growing the release team, growing its processes, starting this emeritus advisor role, which is essentially maybe an older release team lead or older release team subgroup lead back into a future release and have them guide the process, not quite from the shadows, but in the back. Background, allowing a role where shadows could reach out for mentorship, problems that are happening within their team, and kind of building the sustainability across time. So going to your question, I think doing all of that has allowed leaders within our SIG to kind of emerge. When we were thinking about transition, one of the things that we had planned for is this is not something that we're going to do forever. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we had initially planned for was first we brought in SIG technical leads, and it's the first time SIG release had technical leads as of last year. We brought in two of our folks who had been doing incredible work on the release engineering and the release engineering subproject, as well as the release team subproject, and brought them in to kind of, again, steer this across cycles instead of from this quarterly standpoint. And then from there, we've seen more people grow into these roles. As Tim's rotation happens, we're bringing in Sasha, who came in as a technical lead, Jorge, who is technical lead on the release team CI Signal side. Jorge remains a technical lead. Sasha is coming up to become a chair, focus more on the people aspect of the SIG process and administrivia. And then Dan Mangum, who has been a phenomenal shot through the ranks on the release engineering side, has been a phenomenal member of the team. We're bringing him in to essentially replace Sasha as technical lead. We're slowly seeing leaders emerge and present themselves with the work that they're doing and rewarding them for that by giving them more work, I guess. One thing I'd love to point out regarding the leadership overall is one of the best things that we've done for the SIG is actually dovetailing into the SIG PM-iness of it all, is we brought on the community's first program manager. Mm-hmm. Lori Apple is the program manager for SIG release, and she is also one of the enhancement subproject owners for SIG architecture. With all of these folks in the room, now it's starting to feel like something that is truly sustainable is not on any one person's shoulders, continuing to learn and grow through that. I thank Tim for his work. He has been phenomenal. He's not going away. He doesn't have the hat on, helping me and the rest of the group build something that is more sustainable than it was when we walked in.
After the death of George Floyd in May and the protests that ensued around the US, there were two things that happened in the Kubernetes project that you were involved in that I'd like to hear about. First was a banner message committing that racism is unacceptable in the Kubernetes community. And the second is a program to go through the Kubernetes code base and ensure that the naming of everything was inclusive. Can you tell me a bit about the decisions behind and the execution of those two programs?
First, with the banner, it's a no-brainer. For a lot of communities, it's can we say the words and then apply the action to it? I think a lot of the efforts, quote unquote, that have happened in various areas have been, are they as deep as people expect them to be or think they actually are? With the Kubernetes community, it's in the name. We are a community. We are a family. These are people who are my friends. These are people who are my family. And I think that part of being a community is making sure that we're inclusive. Part of being inclusive is not being afraid to say things that are important to your community members, mm-hmm. saying we support you. We support you in what you're doing. We support you in the base idea of existing. That shouldn't be hard to say. So that banner was honestly a no-brainer. I chatted with steering about, we have to say something, even if it's just a start. Mm-hmm. We can't not say something. We're the Kubernetes community. We can't not say something. We hacked up the banner, hacked up the ability to post announcements. This also turned into enhancement for the website, being able to publish announcements in general. Now, steering and docs are also working through a policy to determine how announcements go onto the website, how they're approved, how long they stay, just to make sure that this process is, again, sustainable over time, gives us the opportunity to use our voice as a community to say things that are important. I don't believe this is to be something that is political in any way. It is human. None of what we do in Cloud Native is about technology. It's really about making life easier for the people that we work with and the people that come to depend on the products that we have. That's the banner. Wrapped into that was, that can't be it. Just a banner feels hollow. What are we going to do? If you dig into K website and Kubernetes history, you'll see some issues around handling naming overall. If you think about the handling of pet sets, stateful sets, or the naming of minions to nodes, we've had the conversations before. The master conversation has come up in the past, and that issue is incredibly heated. People not understanding the decision. Project elders, Brian Grant is the one who's like, this is too heated. Lock the issue and close it out. It wasn't a productive conversation. Any issue that you open like that is essentially a troll magnet. Lots of that happened. This issue kind of kicked back up on the mailing list last year. What year is it?
It's hard to tell these days.
Yeah, it was a thread about the way we name control plane nodes, the way we name components. And kind of having that discussion through where the individual components of Kubernetes clusters are nodes, and you sprinkle some stuff on nodes. Some of those nodes hold special roles. You think about the control plane of Kubernetes. It's not any one role. It's the set of components that comprise that classification. I'll talk about the naming stuff in a bit, but just in general, it's ambiguous. The language is incendiary. When that thread popped up, we had some fruitful discussion, but no one took action. Some of the hats that I wear, I'm cautious of putting on too many hats. It's something that I wanted to give the space for someone to step up and start charging forward with. During the George Floyd protests and everything that had been going on with Black Lives Matter, I dug up the issue and said, okay, it's time we did something.
Now's the time.
It's almost a year to the day when we looked at it again. And I was like, all right, let's do something. It sounds like we know what we want to do. What do we do in Kubernetes when we know what we want to do? We form an effort. We form some sort of governance group, sub-project, working group, SIG, what have you. It's time to form a working group. This seems it is an effort that touches multiple SIGs, and that's the definition for a working group. It's cross-collaboration across multiple governance groups, and then it's also something that can be considered to be time-bounded. With time-bounded in quotes, it depends.
Some number of decades, maybe.
Yeah, so we went forth, and we knew that we needed to pull together a few different types of people. We needed leaders and active members in SIG architecture. We needed folks in SIG docs. We needed folks that are on, in, around steering, contributor experience, as well as the code of conduct committee. That's what we put together. Myself, I'm around. I do stuff. I do a few things in the community. Zach is now an emeritus SIG docs chair. I love any opportunity I get to work with Jace and being part of the code of conduct committee, as well as in and around steering and being a project elder. Celeste as well. Celeste is a senior technical writer at CNCF, as well as a very active SIG docs member. We thought we put together the right group. You'll hear throughout the conference as we talk about naming, it's really, how can we do this once? We want to build something that is repeatable enough that it can be carried into different open source projects. It can be carried into larger LF and CNCF efforts. It can be carried outside of the cloud native community without hopefully much burden. What we've recently done is lay down a framework for language evaluation, templates for making recommendations about these changes, as well as really what the workflow should look like. How do we take a recommendation from inception to having that thoughtful discussion about making changes, as well as actual execution and who is responsible for execution. What becomes interesting about the group is that you have these parallel efforts happening where the first part of it for us is making sure that, again, I say the sustainability, right? Making sure that we build a process that is sustainable and is repeatable for the community. And then also making sure that the recommendations can be sticky. Because some of these terms are so contentious, we don't want to have to go through a reversal of any decision to make the process sticky enough that the justification is there to keep it in place. The parallel track is we're full of energy, this community, and people are ready to contribute where they need to contribute. People already started making the changes. People already started renaming Git branches and swizzling search and replaces for various terms. And corralling those efforts and making sure that the active work is starting to fall in line with the active work for developing the framework and working to backfill any of those decisions. So it is a recommendation that is sticky. So that's a lot of what we've been doing so far. What has been really great to see is the evolution of that work into the various companies that we work with, as well as thinking about the work internally at VMware and knowing that when they were looking around for references, they found our docs and asked, are these great docs to use? Have you seen this before? And they're like, yes, we wrote it. We have a decent amount of confidence in it. Seeing that goal realized of not repeating the work, being able to reuse those frameworks across full areas. And that's evolved into this inclusive naming initiative that, again, the first community meeting for is later in the week. So it's been really exciting to, one, see these ideas turn into reality, and then also get an opportunity to work with all of these incredible people across companies who are dedicated to open source projects, standards, organizations, as well as the LF and CNCF. That's exciting. And the work is just getting started.
Well, you've definitely got a lot going on, not least with the conference this week. Just to end up, Dan Conn, as the previous executive director of the CNCF, was a constant presence on stage at these events and was also responsible for selecting the co-chairs for the event. I wondered if you wouldn't mind sharing a few memories of your interactions with Dan, who passed away earlier this month.
Dan, just an amazing guy. And if you have the opportunity, go and check out the Memorials CNCF repo to see just all of the stories that people have shared about Dan. One of the common threads across all of those stories is community, building real community, giving people opportunities for leadership and giving them the space to realize that. It's definitely part of the story for Constance and myself. It's interesting to recognize some of the work that you do is maybe bigger than you realize. And this is not just for me, this is for everyone. Don't discount the work that you do. Everyone has a streak of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. But having people consistently come to you and give you that space to learn and grow, Dan is 100% one of those people. Those stories tell everything. My last conversation was about accepting the role for KubeCon chair. Dan was heading off to China, and Dan and I both live in New York. It's constantly on and off a plane, ships passing in the night. If you think about the conferences and my first few KubeCons, I did, I think, 6 or 7 talks a piece, flitting between room to room, not really recognizing your impact or your potential impact to the community, and maybe not feeling like you are important enough to go talk to that person. We were talking about that earlier. I felt that way a little bit with Dan. He's too important. He doesn't have the time. Mm-hmm. I remember a time for the Open Source Leadership Summit where, you know, I was outside getting some fresh air, detoxing after a chat, and Dan was on the phone, looked like he was in a very serious conversation, and paused the conversation to turn to me like, hey, Steven, how's it going? And just take a few moments to chat. That's the kind of dude he was. Very friendly, very caring about this community, and very much about giving people opportunities. I did not expect to become a KubeCon chair. I didn't know what the path was to be considered for that even. So one, get the offer from Dan, and to get the play-by-play of how that happened from Nancy, kind of warms your heart to know that the impact that you're having is deep enough to be considered for something like this. More than anything, my goal is to make this one of the best conferences that you ever go to.
Or don't go to, as the case may be.
Or attend virtually. That's the last conversation I had with him, and I think that that would be what he would want.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for sharing that memory with us, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Craig.
You can find Steven on the KubeCon keynote stage. After that, you'll find him on the CNCF and Kubernetes Slacks, on Twitter at Steven Augustus, or on the web at just.agst.us. You couldn't get august.us?
It was the thing about dropping the U's, right?
Thanks for listening. Thanks for making it to the end. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you'll find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. If you're listening live, remember, we're taking a 2-week break, and we'll see you again in December. Until then, take care.
See you later.